In a country like India, right? So the number of people who are active on the web far exceeds populations of most countries. But then there's a significant fraction of our population that still doesn't have access to the web and access to the services that are being provided on the web.
Welcome to this episode of Untangling the Web, a podcast of the Web Science Trust. I am Noshir Contractor, and I will be your host today. On this podcast, we bring in thought leaders to explore how the web is shaping society and how society, in turn, is shaping the web. Today, I have the pleasure to welcome Ravindram Balaraman, Ravi for short, who you just heard discussing the unique challenges people in India face accessing the web. Ravi is the Mindtream Faculty Fellow and a professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the Indian Institute of Technology, Madras. He also heads the Robert Bosch Center for Data Science and Artificial Intelligence at IIT Madras, which is the leading interdisciplinary AI research center in India. It was also India's first lab to join the Web Science Trust network of laboratories from around the world. He co-founded the India chapter of the Association for Computing Machinery's Special Interest Group on Knowledge Discovery and Data Mining, SIGKDD for short. And he's currently the president of that chapter. His research is pushing the boundaries of reinforcement learning, social network analysis, and data text mining. And his work bridges the gap between theory and practice in machine learning. In 2019, he was instrumental in hosting the first Web Science Symposium in India. And in 2020, he was recognized as a senior member of AAAI, the Association for Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, for his significant accomplishments within the field of AI. Welcome, Ravi.
Thank you, Noshir, for having me on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for joining us. I must say that I'm especially thrilled to have you as the first guest on this particular series that is joining us from the Global South. I'm absolutely delighted to have your insights about what web science means and can do or can't do in the emerging economies of the world. You've mentioned, for example, that there are many India-specific challenges that need to be addressed by web science. What do you think web science means in the context of countries like India?
In a country like India, right? So the number of people who are active on the web far exceeds populations of most countries. But then there's a significant fraction of our population that still doesn't have access to the web and access to the services that are being provided on the web. There is this digital divide, which people talked about when IT services became more popular. And now with the growth of the web, the societal interactions that are happening on the web, this kind of digital divide is getting exacerbated. It's getting much worse. Recently, colleagues of mine from our social sciences department, they have been looking at the impact of this worsening digital divide on the migrant population, and in particular, their access to digital banking. So with the enablement of digital banking, there is so much more of our commerce now, even in India, happens online, right? And there is a significant fraction of the society that's getting excluded from that. The migrant population, because they are now actually been, you know, transplanted into a slightly alien culture for them within the country, right? They don't want to use these web services that are available for the rest of the country. They don't want to use them because they are feeling even more alien. This is not within their realm of experience. One of the theories that we are posing now is that maybe we should use techniques from AI to make sure that these interfaces on the web that these people are getting access to reminds them of home, as opposed to having an impersonal voice that's going to talk to them about, okay, you want to do banking and press this number or press that, you know, and then enter something here. So can we have somebody talk to them in their local dialect? Their portal to the web now becomes more like a slice of home. Given that very few countries have this kind of large internal migrant population like India does, it's a problem that literally we have to buckle down and start solving. So let's take one concrete example. Like almost 80 to 90% of the construction workers in India are people who are displaced internally. These are people who move in from, so there's a particular state in the north of the country called Bihar. And most of the construction workers in my state, my home state, which is the southernmost state in the country, come from Bihar. And it's a completely different culture, not just language, from the way we dress, the climate, and the kind of festivals that we celebrate here, the food that is available to them, everything is different, right? So it's really an alien country for them, and they tend to stick close to one another, right? And then you tell them that, okay, the government is offering you, you know, schemes. All you have to do is go online, you know, click a few buttons on your smartphone. All of them have smartphones, which is very surprising, right? All of them have smartphones, and they use that to connect with their families back home and just call them or, you know, link with them on WhatsApp. So they are happy to do that. Not that they can't get online, but they can't integrate with the larger web community, mainly because they just want to use it as a conduit for connecting back home. My colleague in the social sciences department has been doing a lot of study on migrant populations within India. And so we are drawing on the insights that he has looked at from their assimilation into local society, and then trying to look at how that affects their assimilation into the web. And then the insights that we have looked at is that the web actually gives us an opportunity to give them a slice of home. But then if you can tell them, okay, all your interactions with the web can happen in a local language, and then you log into a portal, and then it starts greeting you with you know, local functions, local festivals, and starts asking you about your parents and stuff like that. So that's the kind of idea that we are looking at. But that's a solution that has to come from India.
You touched on something at the start that I want to go back to. You mentioned that as a result of the digital divide, difference in access has been exacerbated recently. And I want you to tell us a little bit more about the extent to which you think the presence of the web has contributed to this digital access divide, and or the extent to which AI is now becoming so permeated on the web is either mitigating or exacerbating these digital divide issues that you touched on.
Almost every web service that you see online, right? Whether it is like online communities like Facebook or professional communities like LinkedIn, or whether you're looking at services like Amazon or Google, everything is strongly infused with AI. This enablement of AI is essentially making people rely more and more on these services because they are so much more convenient. Companies, because they are looking at where their bulk of their revenues are coming from, are tending to move more online. And so it makes it harder and harder for people to get services locally. So those who are not online are actually getting lesser and lesser services. So it is certainly exacerbating the divide. Really, right now we are looking at how to make the online access easier for people.
It's depressing in some ways to hear you say that AI might actually be exacerbating the divide, but you're also looking and exploring at ways AI can be deployed to mitigate some of these access and divide issues. Could you give a specific example of something that is happening in India that gives you hope?
Language is an important thing, right? So most of the interfaces now have improved tremendously in India. Then a lot of companies are actually investing money in India to build local language interfaces. And my mother tongue is Tamil, and I can talk to my phone in Tamil, and it does a perfectly fine job of transcribing it. Even if I give you a Tamil keyboard, right? I mean, so in fact, anyone who has tried using a Tamil keyboard know that it's much, much harder to use than an English keyboard. I would prefer typing in English than typing in Tamil, but I would love to talk in Tamil than in English. I can see more people getting integrated because of that. I still think AI is, at the end of the day, a technology, right? It's up to us to figure out how to use it. And that is a stronger awareness among the government, as well as among some of the bigger enterprises. We have to actually start providing all these services in a more accessible manner. And that, you know, realization now taking ground.
You point out a really important issue that we tend to take for granted in many of the developed countries. In India alone, according to the Census of India in 2001, there were 122 major languages in one country, and 30 of these languages were spoken by more than a million native speakers. So what you just described, the technology of using ways of translating these across languages, really helps connectivity on the web in a way that we take for granted when we speak one dominant language in the West. Can you talk a little bit about the ways in which the study of artificial intelligence has in and of itself changed as a result of the web? I remember going back several years when the initial Dartmouth studies were coming together to coin the term artificial intelligence. AI was mostly seen as a rule-based system where you would provide certain rules and certain kinds of reasoning systems. And today, that seems somewhat antiquated, or is it?
Oh, yeah, it is. That's a huge debate. AI seems to go through these phases, right? So where at one point of time, we say, oh, it is all about logic, reasoning, rules, and inferencing on it. And then the next point of time, we say, oh, no, throw out everything. You have to learn everything from data, learn from scratch. It's all about statistics. We are seeing a strong swing towards the data-driven statistical approach to AI. And part of the reason is the web. Right? So it has been both something that really helped AI grow because it's giving you huge volumes of data. It's not only just giving you data, right? But it's also giving you data with tags on there. And because people are so good at labeling what they are putting out on the web, because everything is becoming more and more digital, that data getting readily digitized. Some of the techniques that AI is using now have been around for a couple of decades, if not longer. Like that they couldn't succeed because they didn't have this kind of volume of data that the web has enabled us to gather. Right. So in that way, the web has had significant influence on the growth of AI. At the same time, I also have to say that if you look at some of the latest AI systems built completely on web data, you kind of see that they also tend to mimic the significant biases and prejudices that people bring to their writings and, you know, things that they post on the web. And if you don't do a careful curation of what the data that you're getting from the web, you're going to systematize the biases by putting it into a machine. And it actually makes it easier for people to make the argument, hey, humans can be biased, but machines can't be. But then what they fail to see is that the machine is going to be biased because it's digesting the biased data that the people are putting out on the web. So in some sense, it was great all that the web did, and it really gave a quantum boost to what AI was doing. But we have come to a point where we have to start thinking very carefully about how we are going to take advantage of data on the web.
So Ravi, one of the examples that got a lot of attention in the US, at least, was the fact that, exactly as you said, if you used AI to screen job candidates, then these AI systems will reproduce the same biases in terms of gender and underrepresented minorities in terms of interviewing and screening for job opportunities, et cetera. And one of the issues that raised was that very often these kinds of AI give you a result, but don't necessarily explain how and why they got those results. Some of my friends joke that what AI lacks is a why button, and that if AI gives a result, you should be able to press a button that says why. And this has raised the whole issue of explainable AI. Can you talk a little bit about whether you see that as helping address the issue and the concern that you just raised, but also how far are we from being able to have explainable AI?
So I strongly believe that before AI can be truly, you know, let out free in the wild, we need to solve the explainable AI question. The job screening thing was something that was pretty obviously AI going wrong, right? But then there are a lot of subtle ways in which AI is influencing our behavior. If I go online, my phone starts recommending news stories for me, then it's going to start coloring my view of what kind of stories that I'm going to see. That's just because the AI system is learning this and then it's putting this out. So it very quickly customizes it for your preferences. We need to have something similar to the Y button. The AI doesn't have that yet. What people do nowadays as explainable AI is to say that, you asked me why I said that particular image is appropriate for your search. I say, I want to see a football match. And then it shows me a picture of a football match, and it might say something like, oh, Dad, here at this top right corner, there is something that that cost me to make it into a football match. So it can't even tell you that, okay, oh, I think it's a football match because there are this like 10 people here and there's one guy carrying a ball. It basically says, okay, that is this part of the image which makes me think that it is a football match. That's certainly not a satisfying notion of explanation for people. So we are quite a way from getting to explainability as humans understand explainability. And I'm not even sure how soon we will be able to get there. But this is what I always tell people. You don't know how a motor vehicle runs, but you're happy to drive a car around. The reason you're happy to drive a car around is because you know that there is somebody at least back there who understands and has done all the testing and everything for you. If you can come to a point where I can say that I know why my AI did this, me being an AI expert, right? As long as I can say that, okay, I understand the explanations my AI is putting out, and I'm happy to certify that the AI is doing the right thing. The general public would just have to accept it. Okay, it's come with the certification from AI expert that they understood what it is doing. But if you're going to say that, yeah, it has to go to a point where the general lay public, the end user, is going to understand completely what the AI is doing, I think there's still ways off from that.
To what extent do you think that AI is enhancing trust on the web or undermining it for the lay public?
I mean, I can tell you what I see around me, like at least in the large fraction of the Indian society, right? So we unfortunately tend to trust the web too much. The latest WhatsApp forward is taken as gospel. That's mainly because the forward comes from a person that they know, and therefore they transfer the trust that they have on the person to the message that's been sent through them as well. So the web, in some sense, really worsen the impact of rumors and things like that, because you have a verifiable immediate source that sends you the information. And we tend to kind of ascribe the same trust to that piece of information as well, right? Even though the person who forwarded it to you might not have known where the message came from. When we get in news from newspapers, and I mean, there is at least the hope that appropriate research has been done before things are put on print. And I'm not sure whether AI is still playing a role here in terms of making this worse or better. But I think AI can play a role in making things much, much better in terms of attaching provenance or at least doing a very, very quick analysis of the consistency of information on the web. The biggest challenge in fact-checking all the information that floats out on the web is we don't really know what the ground truth is. And the rate at which information is generated on the web, you can't also go after the ground truth. At least AI systems operating at scale can verify the consistency of the information that's out there. If there are like 10 people saying one thing and 10 people saying something completely different, then at least you can say that, hey, look, I don't think this is right, because there's just too many different opinions about this.
In the past year in particular, with the pandemic and the other global reckonings, there has been a heightened focus on social justice issues. I want you to talk a little bit about what social justice means specifically within the Indian context, and to what extent does the societal interplay and impact of AI and web have for social good in India?
Throughout the country, this whole notion of social justice is very strongly embedded in terms of opportunities in jobs, in academics, and everywhere. Right? It's significantly different from state to state. And there are places where this kind of social inequities are much more pronounced. It could be that the same community in the society is discriminated against in one state, but not in another state. I mean, it's a very, very, very complex dynamic within the country. So it's not clear how you would build AI systems that are uniformly fair across the entire country. And as far as social good is concerned, so there are various issues that people have looked at, which they built solutions for in the West or in other countries, which kind of we struggle with implementing in India, because just implementing a system that would work for a million users alone, even though it would help the million users, is grossly unfair to the Indian population.
Can you explain more why it's unfair?
It's unfair in the sense that which million are you going to deploy this to? Right? So who do you choose? Of course, there are a whole bunch of other factors that are going to come into play in terms of to which fraction of the population do you have access that you're able to deploy your system to. There are a whole bunch of other factors that are going to come into play, right? We really need to figure out a way to scale it much, much larger, a couple of orders of magnitude larger than what we can do right now with our systems in order to make it truly countrywide.
It sounds like what you're describing is a scaling problem. Help me understand why scaling is such a challenge.
Let's say that I've developed a system that tells me that, here are people with a certain medical conditions and, they are having difficulty, keeping to their drug regime. And you have to do some intervention to help them. Now I come up with a system that can look at, analyze a million people and then filter out 1,000 people who need to have this kind of intervention. And then I can actually put healthcare workers who can go help these 1,000 people. Now I scale it. Now suddenly I'm looking at 100,000 people who need this kind of intervention. So a system that worked where I could have this kind of physical intervention going to 1,000 people, maybe I hire 100 people and put them, you know, send them to 10 patients each. And now that won't work anymore. I have to start thinking fundamentally differently in terms of what kind of intervention should help responsible. So that's scaling. It's just not a question of computation being hard. It's a question of actual deployment on the field that makes it much harder to scale.
So the challenge is not just in the technology, and the web might help us identify those who are in need, but that still begs the question of how are we going to reach all those people in any physical, tangible way to provide the need that the technology has helped identify. In closing here, one of the questions that we've been asking our guests is that as we have been going through 2020 and now into 2021, we've been dealing with obviously the pandemic, as well as many global reckonings, sociocultural in nature, political in nature. And I was curious to get your take specifically from an Indian vantage point on how you think this period, 2020 and 2021, would have been different for better or for worse without the web.
Oh man, I can't imagine 2020 without the web. We literally lived on the web. Not only was I working on the web, I was meeting friends and everything, right? So I just can't imagine how we would have survived 2020 without this kind of online work and online meetings that were happening. I strongly feel that things would have been for the worse in the last year without the web. And you might have as well thought of how would they have gone through 2020 without electricity.
Yes, indeed. Yes, it's become a utility that we take for granted in most cases now. Well, I want to thank you again very much, Ravi, for taking time to talk with us, and specifically for giving us insights into how web science has a different lens when seen from the context of the developing world, in this case, particularly from India. And we're just delighted that IIT Madras, the Indian Institute of Technology Madras, became the first member of the Web Science Trust Network of Laboratories from India. And you were certainly instrumental in making that happen. And I wish you and your colleagues the very best in helping advance the notion of web science in developing countries. And we'll be looking forward to hearing more about those insights in the years to come. So thank you very much, Kim.
Thank you, Marshall, for having me.
Untangling the Web is a production of the Web Science Trust. This episode was edited by Molly Lubas. I am Noshir Contractor. You can find out more about our conversation today in the show notes. Thanks for listening.